Chapter 33. Sean was surprised to find himself fully dressed and lying on top of his bed when he woke next morning. It was still half dark outside the hotel windows, and the room was cold. He propped himself up on one elbow and rubbed at his eyes with the back of a clenched fist. Then he remembered, and he swung his legs off the bed and looked at Katrina's bed. The blankets were thrown back, and it was empty. Sean's first feeling was relief. She'd recovered enough to get up on her own. He went through to the bathroom, stumbling a little from the stiffness of uneasy sleep. He tapped on the closed door. "Katrina?" he questioned. And then again, louder. "Katrina! Are you in there?" The handle turned when he tried it, and the door swung open without resistance. He blinked at the empty room, white tiles reflecting the uncertain light, a towel thrown across a chair where he'd left it. He felt the first twinge of alarm. Dirk's room. The door was still locked, the key on the outside. He flung it open. Dirk sat up in bed, his face flushed, his curls standing up like the leaves of a sisal bush. Sean ran out into the passage, along it, and looked down into the lobby. There was a light burning behind the reception desk. The clerk slept with his head on his arms, sitting forward on his chair, snoring. Sean went down the stairs three at a time. He shook the clerk. "Has anyone been out through here during the night?" Sean demanded. I don't know. Is that door locked?" Sean pointed to the front door. "No, sir, there's a night latch on it. You can get out, but not in." Sean ran out onto the pavement. Which way? Which way to search for her? Which way had she gone? Back to Pretoria, to the wagons? Sean thought not. She would need transport, and she had no money to hire it. Why should she leave without waking him? Leave Dirk, leave her clothing and disappear into the night? She must have been unbalanced by the drugs the doctor had given her. Perhaps there was something in his theory that she had suffered a shock. Perhaps she was wandering in her nightdress through the streets with no memory, perhaps. Sean stood in the cold, grey Transvaal morning, the city starting to murmur into wakefulness around him, the questions crowding into his head, and finding there no answers with which to mate. He turned and ran back through the hotel, out of the rear door into the stable yard. "Ember Janey!" he shouted. "Ember Janey, where the hell are you?" Ember Janey appeared quickly from the store where he was currying one of the hired horses. "Nkosi, have you seen the Nkosi Kasi?" Ember Janey's face creased into a puzzled frown. "Yesterday." "No, man," shouted Sean. "Today, last night. Have you seen her?" Ember Janey's expression was sufficient reply. Sean brushed impatiently past him and ran into the stable. He snatched a saddle off the rack and threw it onto the back of the nearest horse. While he clinched the girth and forced a bit between its teeth, he spoke to Ember Janey. "The Nkosi Kasi's sick. She left during the night. It's possible that she walks as one who still sleeps. Go quickly among your friends and tell them to search for her. Tell them there's £10 in gold for the one who finds her. Then come back here and care for Dirk until I return." Sean led the horse from the stable, and Ember Janey hurried off to spread the word. Sean knew that within a minute half the Zulus in Johannesburg would be looking for Katrina. Tribal loyalty and £10 in gold were strong incentives. He swung up onto the horse and galloped out of the yard. He tried the Pretoria Road first. 3 miles out of town, a native herd boy grazing sheep beside the road convinced him that Katrina had not passed that way. He turned back. He paid a visit to the police station at Marshall Square. The commandant remembered him from the old days. Sean could rely on his cooperation. Sean left him and rode fast through the streets that were starting to fill with the bustle of a working day. He hitched his horse outside the hotel and took the front steps 3 at a time. The clerk had no news for him. He ran up the stairs and along the passage to his suite. Ember Janey was feeding Dirk his breakfast. Dirk beamed at Sean through a face full of egg and spread his arms to be picked up, but Sean had no time for him. "Has she come back?" Ember Janey shook his head. "They will find her in Kusi. 50 men are searching for her now." "Stay with the child," said Sean, and went down to his horse. He stood beside it, ready to mount, but not knowing which way to go. "Where the hell has she got to?" he demanded aloud. In her nightclothes, with no money, where the hell had she gone? He mounted and rode with aimless urgency through the streets, searching the faces of the people along the sidewalks, turning down the sanitary lanes, and peering into backyards in vacant plots. By midday he had tired his horse and worked himself into a ferment of worry and bad temper. He had searched every street in Johannesburg, made a nuisance of himself at the police station, and sworn at the hotel clerk. But still there was no sign of Katrina. He was riding down Jeppy Street for the fifth time when the imposing double story of Candy's hotel registered through his preoccupation. "Candy," he whispered, "she can help." He found her in her office, among Persian rugs and gilt furniture, walls hung with pink and blue patterned wallpaper, a mirrored ceiling hung with six crystal waterfalls of chandeliers, and a desk with an Indian mosaic top. Sean pushed aside the little man in the black alpaca coat who tried to stop him entering and burst into the room. Candy looked up, and her small frown of annoyance smoothed as she saw who it was.
"Sean, oh, how nice to see you."
She came round from behind the desk, the bell tent of her skirts covering the movement of her legs as she seemed to float. Her skin was smooth white and her eyes were happy blue. She held out her hand to him, but hesitated as she saw his face.
"What is it, Sean?"
He told her in a rush, and she listened, and when he had finished she rang the bell on her desk. "There's brandy in the cabinet by the fireplace," she said. "I expect you're in need of one." The little man in the alpaca coat came quickly to the bell. Sean poured himself a large brandy and listened to Candy giving orders. "Check the railway station. Telegraph the coach stages on each of the main roads. Send someone up to the hospital. Check the registers of every hotel and boarding house in town."
"Very well, madam."
The little man bobbed his head as he acknowledged each instruction, and then he was gone. Candy turned back to Sean.
"You can pour a drink for me also. Then sit down and simmer down. You're behaving just the way she wanted you to."
"What do you mean?" demanded Sean.
"You're being given a little bit of wifely discipline, my dear. Surely you've been married long enough to recognize that."
Sean carried the glass across to her, and Candy patted the sofa next to her.
"Sit down," she said. "We'll find your little Cinderella for you."
"What do you mean, wifely discipline?" he demanded again.
"Punishment for bad behavior. You may have eaten with your mouth open, answered back, taken more than your share of the blankets, not said good morning with the right inflection, or committed one of the other mortal sins of matrimony. But,"
Candy sipped her drink and gasped slightly,
"I see the time has not given you a lighter hand with the brandy bottle."
One Courtney Tot always did equal an imperial gallon.
"But as I was saying, my guess is that little Katie is having an acute attack of jealousy. Probably her first, seeing that the two of you have spent your whole married life out in the deep sticks, and she has never had an opportunity of watching the Courtney charm work on any other female before."
"Nonsense," said Sean. "Who's she got to be jealous of?"
"Me," said Candy. "Every time she looked at me the other night, I felt as though I'd been hit in the chest with an axe."
Candy touched her magnificent bosom with her fingertips, skillfully drawing Sean's attention to it. Sean looked at it. It was deeply cleft and smelt of fresh violets. He shifted restlessly and looked away.
"Nonsense," he said again. "We're just old friends. Almost like..."
He hesitated.
"I hope, my dear, you weren't going to say brother and sister. I shall not be a party to any incestuous relationship. Or had you forgotten about that? Sean hadn't forgotten. Every detail of it was still clear. He blushed and stood up. I'd better be going, he said. I'm going to keep looking for her. Thanks for your help, Candy, and for the drink. Whatever I have is yours, monsieur, she murmured, lifting an eyebrow at him, enjoying the way he blushed. I'll let you know as soon as we hear anything. The assurance that Candy had given him wore thinner as the afternoon went by with no news of Katrina. By nightfall, Sean was again wild with worry. It had completely swamped his bad temper and even anaesthetized his fatigue. One by one, Ember Janey's tritesmen came in to report a blank score. One by one, the avenues Candy's men were exploring proved empty, and long before midnight, Sean was the only hunter left. He rode hunched in the saddle, a lantern in his hand, riding the ground that had already been covered a dozen times, visiting the mining camps along the ridge, stopping to question late travellers he met along the network of roads between the mines. But the answer was always the same. Some thought he was joking. They laughed until they saw that his face was haunted and dark-eyed in the lantern light. Then they stopped laughing and moved hurriedly on. Others had heard about the missing woman. They started to question him, but as soon as Sean realized they couldn't help him, he pushed past them and went on searching. At dawn he was back at the hotel. Ember Janey was waiting for him. Nkosi, I have had food ready for you since last night. Eat now and sleep a little. I will send the men out to search again today. They will find her. Tell them I'll give £100 to the one who finds her. Sean passed his hand wearily across his face. Tell them to hunt the open veldt beyond the ridges. She may not have followed a road. I will tell them. But now you must eat. Sean blinked his eyes. They were red-veined, and each had a little lump of yellow mucus in the corner. Dirk? He asked. He is well, Nkosi. I have stayed with him all the while. Ember Janey took Sean firmly by the arm. There is food ready. You must eat. Saddle me another horse, said Sean. I will eat while you do it. Without sleep, unsteady in the saddle as the day wore on, Sean widened the circle of his search until he was out into the treeless veldt, and the mine headgears were small, spidery triangles on the horizon. A dozen times he met Zulus from the city, big black men in loincloths, moving at their business-like trot, hunting the ground like hounds. There was a concealed sympathy behind their greetings. Ember Janey has told us, Nkosi. We will find her. And Sean left them and rode on alone, more alone than he had ever been in his life before. After dark, he rode back into Johannesburg, the faint flutter of hope inside him stilled as he limped stiffly into the gaslit lobby of the hotel and saw the pity in the reception clerk's face. No word, I'm afraid, Mr. Courtney. Sean nodded. Thanks anyway. Is my son all right? Your servant is taking good care of him, sir. I sent dinner up to him an hour ago. The stairs seemed endless as he climbed them. By God, he was tired. Sick tired and sick with worry. He pushed open the door of his suite and Candy stood up from a chair across the room. The hope flared up in him again. Have you? He started eagerly. No, she said quickly. No, Sean, I'm sorry. He flopped into one of the chairs and Candy poured a drink for him from a decanter that was waiting on the writing desk. He smiled his thanks and took a big gulp at the glass. Candy lifted his legs one at a time and pulled off his boots, ignoring his faint protest. Then she took up her own glass and went to sit across the room from him. I'm sorry I joked yesterday, she apologized softly. I don't think I realize how much you love her. She lifted her glass to him. Here's a speedy end to the search. Sean drank again, half a glass at a swallow. You do love her, don't you? Candy asked. Sean answered her sharply. She's my wife. But it's not only that, Candy went on recklessly, knowing his anger was just below the surface of his fatigue. Yes, I love her. I'm just learning how much I love her, as I'll never be able to love again. He drained his glass and stared at it, his face grey under the brown and his eyes dark with unhappiness. Love, he said. Love, mouthing the word, weighing it. They've dirtied that word. They sell love at the opera house. They've used that word so much that now, when I want to say I love Katrina, it doesn't sound what I mean. Sean hurled the glass against the far wall. It shattered with a crack and a tinkle, and Dirk stirred in the bedroom. Sean dropped his voice to a fierce whisper. I love her, so it screws my gut. I love her so that to think of losing her now is like thinking of dying. He clenched his fists and leaned forward in his chair. I'll not lose her now, by Christ. I'll find her, and when I do, I'll tell her this. I'll tell her just like I'm telling you. He stopped and frowned. I don't think I've ever said to her, I love you. I've never liked using that word. I've said, marry me, and you're my fancy, but I've never said it straight before. Perhaps that's part of the reason she ran away, Sean. Perhaps because you never said it, she thought you never felt it. Candy was watching him with a strange expression, pity and understanding and a little yearning. I'll find her, said Sean, and this time I'll tell her, if it's not too late. You'll find her, and it won't be too late. The earth can't have swallowed her, and she'll be glad to hear you say it. Candy stood up. You must rest now. You have a hard day ahead of you. Sean slept fully dressed in the chair in the sitting room. He slept brokenly, his mind struggling and kicking him back to half-wakefulness every few minutes. Candy had turned the gas low before she left, and its light fell in a soft pool onto the writing desk beneath it. Katrina's Bible lay where she had left it, and each time Sean started awake, the fat, leather-covered book caught his eye. Sometime before dawn he woke for the last time and knew he could not sleep again. He stood up, and his body still ached, and his eyes felt gritty. He moved across to the gas lamp and turned it up high. He let his hand drop from the lamp onto the Bible. Its leather was cool and softly polished beneath his fingers. He opened the front cover and caught his breath with a hiss. Beneath Katrina's name, in her carefully rounded writing, the ink still freshly blue, she had filled in the date of death. The page magnified slowly in front of his eyes until it filled the whole field of his vision. There was a rushing sound in his ears, the sound of a river in flood, but above it he heard voices, different voices. Let's go, Sean, it looks like a grave. But more than anything, she needs love. The earth can't have swallowed her. And his own voice, if it's not too late, if it's not too late. The morning light was gathering strength as he reached the ruins of the old Candy Deep office block. He left his horse and ran through the grass towards the mine dump. The wind was small and cold. It moved the tops of the grass and went on to where Katrina's green shawl was caught on the barbed wire fence that ringed the shaft. In the wind, the shawl flapped its wings like a big green bird of prey. Sean reached the fence and looked down into the mouth of the shaft. At one place, the grass had been torn away from the edge as though someone had snatched at it as they fell. Sean loosed the shawl from the spikes of the barbed wire. He balled the heavy material in his fists, then he held it out over the shaft and let it drop. It spread out as it floated down into the blackness, and it was the bright green of Katrina's eyes. "Why?" whispered Sean. "Why have you done this to us, my fancy?" He turned away and walked back to his horse, stumbling carelessly in the rough footing. Embogeni was waiting for him in the hotel suite. "Get the carriage," Sean told him. "The Nkosikasi." "Get the carriage," Sean repeated. Sean carried Dirk downstairs. He paid his bill at the reception desk and went out to where Embogeni had the carriage ready. He climbed up into it and held Dirk on his lap. "Drive back to Pretoria," Sean said.
"Where's Mummy?"
Dirk demanded. "She's not coming with us."
"Are we going alone?"
Dirk insisted, and Sean nodded wearily. "Yes, Dirk, we're going alone."
"Is Mummy coming just now?"
"No, Dirk. No, she's not." It was finished, Sean thought. It was all over. All the dreams and the laughter and the love. He was too numb to feel the pain yet. It would come later.
"Why are you squeezing me so hard, Daddy?"
Sean slackened his grip and looked down at the child on his lap. It wasn't finished, he realized. It was only a new beginning. But first I must have time for this to heal. Time, and a quiet place to lie up with this wound. The wagons are waiting, and I must go back into the wilderness. Perhaps after another year I will have healed sufficiently to start again, to go back to Ladyburg with my son. Back to Ladyburg, and to Ada, and to Gary, he thought. Then suddenly and sickeningly he felt the pain again, and the deep raw ache of it frightened him. "Please, God," prayed Sean, who had never prayed before. "Please, God, give me the strength to endure it."
"Are you going to cry, Daddy? You look like you're going to cry."
Dirk was watching Sean's face with solemn curiosity. Sean pulled the child's head gently against his shoulder and held it there. "If tears could pay both our debts," thought Sean, "if with my tears I could buy for you an indulgence from all pain, if by weeping now I could do all your weeping for you, then I would cry until my eyes were washed away." "No, Dirk," he answered. "I'm not going to cry. Crying never helps very much." And Embogeni took them to where the wagons waited at Pretoria.